Hello, I'm Dr. Ruth Schmidt-Nevin, clinical psychologist and child psychotherapist. Welcome to Talking Child Development, the podcast of the Association of Child and Family Development in Melbourne, Australia. The association is a not-for-profit organization that aims to disseminate information about all aspects of child and family development to other professionals and the wider community. In these podcasts, we will be going a little deeper into the whys and wherefores of child, adolescent, and family life. We want to get away from a focus that's purely behavioral and quick fix based to delve more deeply into issues and ask questions about why things happen in families the way they do. You can find more information on our website at www.acfd.com.au. You will also be able to access the references mentioned here at the end of the podcast. Today, I am delighted to welcome Dr. Maria Papadima, who is a child and adolescent psychotherapist based in London. Maria is originally from Greece, where she initially studied law and then moved into psychology studies, first becoming interested in systemic family therapy. She subsequently discovered psychoanalytic thinking and did an MSc and PhD in that field. Her PhD focused on trauma, and she is particularly interested in the intersection between psychoanalysis, systemic theory, and psychosocial theory and approaches. Maria has a long interest in working with adolescents and currently works in an adolescent service in London as part of a multidisciplinary team and in private practice. Welcome, Maria. I wonder if we can start with getting your views of adolescents in general today. I think we can all agree that the emotional and social landscape for adolescents has shifted radically, even within the last decade, particularly with the advent of social media. How do you perceive these changes?
Hello, Ruth, and thank you very much for having me. Good morning. I do wonder if adolescence has actually shifted today. This is something that has been, it's being said a lot, isn't it, these days? I think we could think together about what in adolescence is always constant and what has changed. I would guess that adolescence would be always different according to history, according to culture, but perhaps there are some things in the adolescent years that remain constant and that we all know about in our lives and through our work. In terms of what is adolescence and what remains constant, I think in all cultures, we could say it's a period of transition between childhood and adulthood. And the way I would see it, Ruth, I guess, it's like a period of rapid transition, similar to maybe toddlerhood, similar to the menopause, perhaps similar to pregnancy, where the body changes quickly and there are a lot of changes in relationships with parents and with wider society. And also in adolescence, we could say it's a period of big changes in identity formation. So a teenager will try to find who they are as more separate gradually from the family. I think at the moment in the cultures in which we live, in the UK where I live and work, and maybe in Australia where you live and work, we talk a lot about big changes in adolescence today, in particular around social media use. This is discussed as something that makes today's adolescents very different, perhaps to previous times. Another big change, I guess, is that adolescents tend to be today closer to their parents than perhaps they were in previous generations, which I see as a very good thing. And sometimes we hear about adolescents being slower today to grow up. And I think perhaps there's some truth in that in terms of, you know, income inequality and difficulties in entering the labor market in their early 20s. However, I actually think perhaps that these changes are overstated, because in every culture and every time, there will be things as I said before, that remain the same. So I think the discussion about social media is something we can come back to.
Thank you, Maria. I'm very interested in the idea of the certain constants in all these periods of transition, so that we don't always see these processes as being completely different. I suppose what you're sort of getting at, and thank you for reminding us, is that every generation thinks it's unique, or that it's facing unique issues that have never been faced before, or that I think what you're saying is the core of development remains remarkably constant in a sense throughout the ages. I think that's very, very interesting.
Yes, and I think also there is a tendency with social media sometimes, we run the risk of entering into a moral panic where social media can be seen as the devil. And there is research that shows that excessive use of social media and the way adolescents relate to it perhaps can lead to an increase in anxiety or even an increase in depression sometimes. However, it also offers them social connections. It offers them information very easily, very quickly. So in every generation, as you say, there would always be things, new changes that the older generations would feel threatened by and sometimes identify adolescents as bringing in this really dangerous new thing. So I guess I'm always aware of that.
Yes, I think that's a very important point. But, you know, so I suppose perhaps I'm one of the older generation that feels that at times social media has completely encapsulated adolescence. And I know we share a concern about, I think you've mentioned it as the mental health discourse or the medicalization discourse in which many adolescents today feel that their ordinary distressed feelings are somehow abnormal rather than being part of the process of growing up. And what are your thoughts about that?
Yes, it's true that social media in particular and the way the media talks about mental health today is something quite new, isn't it? There is a lot of talk and information about conditions such as anxiety, depression, suicidality, self-harm in the media and in adolescents' social media sites. I guess I'm interested in whether that's different in adults, how we understand our mental health, whether there's a difference in adults and in adolescents. There is certainly less stigma nowadays about talking about mental health, which in some ways is a good thing. However, we run the risk, and I think particularly with adolescents, of widening this a bit too much, in my opinion. And many adolescents, because also they don't have enough life experience, what we see in our work is that they will often have an understanding of conditions such as anxiety or depression that is too wide. And what that means is that they will often experience distress and label it quite quickly as anxiety or depression. And social media doesn't really help with this because these discussions they have amongst themselves in some ways helpfully, but as I said, in some ways unhelpfully.
Yes.
And I do think this happens in adults as well, but the difference is that adults have more life experience, are more able to understand the difference between ordinary life ups and downs and distress versus something more entrenched and, you know, worrying and pathological. So often the other problem we have in the UK is that there is a lot of talk on social media and in mental health campaigns about being open about one's mental health and getting help. And that is, of course, correct. However, there is not much help in the UK available. There is not enough preventative work. There are not enough adolescent clinics. And there is an expectation of help at a time when there is, after 10 years of austerity, there is limited help available and certainly limited preventative help available. So that creates a very difficult combination of factors. And the adolescents we do see in our work, one of my main aims when I would meet a teenager would often be to try to understand what they mean by the terms they use, such as anxiety, depression, if they can describe in their own personal way, so that we can start thinking together about what of that can be managed as part of ordinary life and what is more worrying and needs, you know, mental health treatment or a mental health label. Labels are not always helpful.
Yes, I mean, I would totally agree, and I certainly agree that throughout the Western world, there's a lot of talk about supporting children, young people. There's a huge amount of the whole idea of mental health and being mentally healthy has expanded, but the services for that have absolutely are disappearing. But you made a point earlier, which I thought was very interesting, which is that you thought that there are certain constants and certain differences about adolescence today. One of the differences you said is that adolescents are closer to their parents than they may have been at an earlier time. And yet I think one of the problems about social media is that adolescents perhaps trust social media more or communicate more via social media than they may do with their parents. So that the parents might in some cases be a bit sidelined. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I guess in adolescence, it's normal thinking back to our own, you know, when we were 15. And I guess in every adolescent, in every period of adolescence, in every culture, moving a little bit away from parents is normal to some degree. So I'm not surprised that adolescents turn to their friends to learn about the world more than they would in their earlier years. It's true that social media and the internet has a quality that is, you know, draws one in. And it is often the case, particularly with phones, that adolescents spend really excessive amounts of time on their phones and learn about the world a lot through that. But so, as I said, on the one hand, I see that as quite normal. And in all generations, we would see the same phenomenon. Turning towards friends and their own peer group is the developmental task of adolescence. But at the same time, it's true that with social media, misinformation can spread much more quickly than it would perhaps with traditional media. And there is a problem there that we need to keep an eye on.
I suppose just sort of linking in with that one of the other things I've become aware of is that adolescence seems no longer to be considered as a period of development, as a journey, of finding out about yourself, about having the space and the time to think about who you are. I have a sense of a sort of premature pushing of adolescence into adulthood. These days, it seems as though adolescents are increasingly bombarded with adult expectations and under pressure to conform to or respond to adult world expectations and issues on a variety of levels, whether it's about identity, sexual identity, a very wide range of issues. And it does rather concern me. And I just wonder what your thoughts are about that.
I think I agree, Ruth. There is... Nowadays, there is, of course, in our political landscape, a big turn towards identity politics and finding one's identity. And there is a lot of important benefit in that, in terms of race, in terms of gender, in terms of sexuality. Opening up these questions and these dialogues is very important. However, adolescence is a period of change and constant development, and finding one's identity, apart from it being a lifelong process anyway for all of us, is particularly the case for teenagers. And I do think it's a problem in today's adolescents that they very much seek an identity quite early on. When I say an identity, I mean in all sorts of areas in their lives, including a mental health identity sometimes. For example, seeing themselves as depressed, which they may be, but there is also the possibility of hope and change and more transient phenomena, which they sometimes find hard to grasp and think of it that way. So I've noticed today that adolescents very often will fix onto certain identities quite early, and this is encouraged, I would think, quite unhelpfully by the way we understand identity in wider culture. And it is important to help them think about the normality of change, the kind of ordinary developmental task of adolescence, which is to change, to find oneself, to try on different identities, and to accept that this change can sometimes be quite dramatic, but that is normal, rather than to stay very early on with certain identities. And that is, I think, something that needs further thought in today's culture. And I don't have easy answers on it, but it is a very big part of my own work with families and teenagers.
I think it's very much about the a tolerance for uncertainty and a tolerance for allowing young people to grow. You know, it's almost like somebody once said something about pulling up a plant, you know, pulling it out of the ground by its roots to see how it's growing. And when we really just need to be patient and allow the plant to grow in the form of the young person.
Yes, I think, I'm not sure I want to generalize too much, but I have noticed that in our world today, uncertainty is something we fight against very strongly. It is not very easily tolerated by most young people. And I wonder if that was different in the past or not, but certainly yes. Today, that is something we really grapple with in yes. our work.
I wonder if we could move on to the sharp end, so to speak, and to your current work with adolescents in London. I'm interested in the aim of your service to provide a rapid response when adolescents and their families present with specific problems. Can you describe these problems and also the age that you focus on in your service?
So I work with young people from 13 years and above and up to 18 or 19. And this is both in my independent work, private work, and in my clinic, which is in the NHS. And in my clinic, because we aim to see families and young people very quickly, and we see young people who present with difficulties that need a quick response. They will usually present in a crisis, and most of them will come to our service, for example, after a suicide attempt or because they're self-harming or because they have psychotic symptoms or possible psychotic symptoms that need investigation, or if there is another kind of complex presentation that needs a rapid response. So the aim of our service is, because of these particular types of problems, it's very, very important to see the family very quickly. So, and of course it's worth saying that in adolescence, as in every period in life where there is more intense and more rapid change, there are crises in families. There are periods of crises that need attention quickly. And some of these crises will resolve relatively quickly with some support. Other of these crises will lead to more ongoing difficulties that we have to treat and think about.
So these are very challenging issues. And I wonder if we can start with psychotic symptoms in adolescents, which is an area that's hard to diagnose, while at the same time, as you're saying, it's essential to diagnose via early intervention to prevent a severe breakdown at a later stage. And we've previously discussed the concept of prodromal symptoms, which refer to the particular behaviors of the young person that often precede the full-blown illness or psychotic state in young people. Do you find this concept useful, and how would you proceed with identifying these worrying symptoms in young people?
There is a paradox, I think, in adolescence. On the one hand, this is the age when some more serious mental health illnesses will emerge, the first signs of them. For example, psychotic illnesses will very often, in the vast majority of cases, I think, actually, first present in the late adolescent years. and other mental illnesses that will become lifelong, the first signs we see them in adolescence. So on the one hand, it is a period of time where we need to pay special attention to doing preventative work and identifying these problems as early as possible, because we know that offering that early help will prevent the problem becoming entrenched and continuing into adult life. But then at the same time, in adolescence, just because of the normal characteristics of that period of life, often there will be a lot of risk-taking, often there will be more intense and worrying behaviors that, however, are not linked to a more serious mental illness. So we need to be able to differentiate what's going on. You know, is this what we could call more normal, temporary an adolescent problem that will pass and that we can help with, but it doesn't really signify a psychosis, for example? Or are we seeing what we call the prodromal signs of a psychosis? So for example, what I mean by that is the early signs of symptoms that may then lead to something like schizophrenia or a more serious bipolar disorder and other psychotic conditions. And I suppose what we would be looking out for in young people who do eventually have a psychotic illness, the early signs I think we would be looking for would be, I think there's an intense, in the prodromal stage of psychosis, there is an intense anxiety in adolescence, which I think I've noticed is quite different to other forms of anxiety. It's a sort of all-encompassing anxiety that is not really linked to a particular thing. Like, it's not a phobia, it's not linked to, a particular fear. It's a sense of dread that something is really deeply wrong, a very deep anxiety we notice. I also think we need to be really looking carefully at things like hearing voices, which actually is very frequent in adolescents, very often not linked to psychosis, very often linked to anxiety or other conditions like obsessionality. We need to be looking also very carefully at adolescents who start to neglect themselves quite rapidly. For example, they stop washing themselves, they stop eating in their normal patterns, they start sleeping in a very strange way. Intense mood swings, but that can be, as I said, normal. In some cases, it can be of concern. And finally, I think intense withdrawal is important to look at. If an adolescent starts withdrawing much more than the normal, ordinary, adolescent going into the room and not talking to parents that much, something more pronounced of that we need to keep an eye on. So all these things together, and of course, each person is very different, but all these things together we would want to investigate and assess.
Yes, well, I think you put it very, very well. It makes a lot of sense. I was just thinking of, what can happen in adolescence, the non-psychotic kind of elements where young people have very intense feelings. And I remember seeing an adolescent boy, because one of the other things is it's very difficult sometimes to get adolescents to come on a regular basis for therapy or for counselling, or they have their own time frame. And I remember seeing a young, I think it was a 15-year-old, who was very intense, and he turned up for one session, then he disappeared, then he reappeared. And his first statement was, "This therapy isn't going anywhere," which was really rather funny since he hadn't appeared. But I remember at the time I had a supervisor who said that was a very significant communication, because in actual fact, in the intervening period, this young man had actually done quite a lot of work internally and wanted to come back because he felt there was a problem, it wasn't going anywhere, he needed some more. So it's a very interesting phenomenon of how adolescents choose their own coming and going to some extent in therapy, and that we have to be very flexible with that.
Yes, I agree completely. And I think as therapists, we often have our own prejudices and expectations about, for example, seeing somebody once weekly in a regular setting. However, with adolescents, that's really not the norm. It is very normal for them to pull away from adults and sources of help and then come back. And that is a challenge we face as therapists and in our assessments, particularly when an adolescent withdraws, as we just described before, or has more worrying symptoms. It's really, really important to try to engage with the family and with the young person exactly where they are, and to use everything we can to reach them where they are. When I say where they are, I don't mean just in terms of space, but in terms of developmental moment and how much they're willing to engage with us. We do need to be far more flexible than we would be with adults, I think. And I suppose the other question, thinking about this question of psychosis and more serious mental health illness in adolescents, one thing perhaps we can touch upon is whether we should be diagnosing conditions in adolescence or not. And it is very important to take into account that adolescents change continuously and sometimes dramatically. And so there could be an argument to be made that diagnosing, for example, conditions such as borderline personality, or even in some cases psychosis as well, has its drawbacks in that age group, and that it's quite wise to wait. But there is a counter argument that I'm aware of, that early diagnosis and naming a problem in certain cases and for certain adolescents and families may be helpful. So again, with this, we have to be flexible, but my personal tendency is to question diagnosis if it's done too early. So to give it a lot of time to be able to put a name on what's going on and to wait and assess really carefully and over time.
So not to go into a kind of foreclosing, which is very important. And that leads into my next question, which is that an area of great concern with adolescents is that of self-harm. And I'm just wondering about your views of the issue of self-harm with respect to cutting amongst young girls. I know you have an interest in this problem and you've thought about it in your work. And the numbers of young girls self-harming via cutting mainly appears to have gone up in recent years. And I just wonder how you might approach a problem like that.
It's true that girls tend to self-harm by cutting more, much more than boys do, that, which is an interesting question why that is. Although some boys also self-harm by cutting. I also want to say, we are focusing on self-harm by cutting in this conversation, but of course there are different types of self-harm. For example, banging one's fist against the wall, or burning oneself. But cutting in particular in the UK where I work is very prevalent these days. One important thing to say is that self-harm is very different and needs to be separated from suicidality. And that's important to share with families, because often parents, very understandably, they will be alarmed by their son or daughter cutting themselves. They will be very distressed by this. And it's important to explain to them that even though it is distressing and to understand that, it is not necessarily, and in most cases, linked to a wish to kill oneself. So that's one important thing to take into account. I think in every culture, Ruth, there are ways that adolescents will express their distress, and these change according to culture and according to historical time. But we will always find in the adolescent years in particular, certain ways to express distress and formulate it, if we could put it that way, will be more prevalent than others. In the UK, at the moment, self-harm is one of the ways adolescents have to show they're in pain. But it is interesting that self-harm in other countries, for example, even today, doesn't exist at all, or is just extremely rare, which we can wonder about why that is. And I want to say that there are mental health problems or clusters of problems in other countries that we don't have in the UK. For example, I'm aware that in Japan, there is a widespread phenomenon called, I think it's called hikikomori, if I'm pronouncing it well, which started in the 90s and which involves a tendency towards extreme withdrawal in Japanese young men. they withdraw into the room, they withdraw from school, they have extreme passivity. So this is something we don't see in the UK in such big numbers. And it did emerge in Japan in a particular cultural context. So I'm very interested in why self-harm is chosen today. The way I approach it in my work is I try to talk to the young people about what it is that drives them to self-harm and what it is they're trying to say with it. And it will be very different for each person, what the meaning of it is really, rather than the action itself. So we will, of course, all of us risk assess and try to understand, you know, how dangerous this behavior is. But in a lot of cases, what's really more important is to understand the meaning, the context, the communication of the self-harm, and what drives it, what feelings and thoughts drive it, rather than how to just immediately get rid of it.
That's very, very interesting. Just staying with the challenging topic of suicidal ideation, we sometimes come across a situation, really horrendous situation where a young person takes their own life, apparently totally out of the blue, despite the fact that to all outward appearances, they were doing well at school, they seemed happy, had lots of friends, and seemingly no one, including their parents, had any idea that anything was wrong. These are such terrible and extraordinary situations. And I just wonder what your thoughts are about this. Could there have been telling signs? Is there some way in which people were not seeing what was going on, or parents were not seeing? I just wonder what your thoughts are.
Well, as you said, when we do have a young person who attempts suicide and manages and does kill themselves, it is an absolute devastation, not just for the family, but also for the community, the school, and the clinicians who may have been seeing this young person. So, of course, in our work, our main hope and aim and effort is to prevent that as much as possible. The reality is that there is a level in which there will be always something we cannot prevent. So there will be a small risk we have to live with adolescents, which is very difficult to accept, but it is realistic because there is a lot of risk taking in adolescents. And sometimes there can be accidental deaths and there can be impulsive suicides that, with the best of intentions, the parents or the clinicians can never predict. But having said that and putting that aside, there are some signs that we need to take very, very seriously, and we can prevent. In most cases, we can work with the family and prevent. So there are some conditions and situations where the risk for suicide needs to be taken very seriously and we need to keep an eye on. One of them is psychosis. So if a young person is in a process of psychotic symptoms, they will be at much more high risk for suicide, and we need to be careful. Young people who are taking substances, drugs, alcohol, sometimes can be at high risk for suicide. When a teenager has done a past suicide attempt, that will also be a risk factor that we need to take seriously. I also think there are some characteristics or ways a teenager behaves before a serious attempt that I've noticed we need to really underline. One of them is when there's a depressed adolescent who has been depressed, for example, for a long time, and suddenly they start being much more angry and agitated, that is something we take very seriously in our work, and we consider it as a risk factor because that agitation can lead to a suicide attempt. And also the lack of connection. So I think an important thing to say is that the immediate risk in terms of what the adolescent is saying to us is one thing we need to take seriously, but whether they have connections, for example, to the family, to their friends, is another thing. So it could be that an adolescent is connected to others, to friends, to family, And even though they say they want to die, actually are at lower risk than an adolescent who may not say they want to die, but is disconnected and quite withdrawn and quite solitary. That one I would perhaps keep in my mind, maybe as even a bigger worry. So we need to look at how connected they are to the world around them, to the community around them, whether they have even one person who they can talk to or not. And we don't only look at what they say about whether they want to die, but also all these other factors that would help us prevent as much as possible. And as I said, there will always be tragedies where nobody can prevent. And we always talk to the parents about that as well.
Yes, that's a very helpful way of putting it. It also reminds me that Donald Winnicott, the psychoanalyst who wrote so much about development, childhood, adolescence, actually talked precisely about this point, that in working with adolescents, we may have to accept that there may be suicide. And
well, in all of life, there is suicide. And
yes,
it is, particularly in adolescence, I guess, it's very difficult for parents to accept this. And I don't think, in a way, I don't think they should accept this. However, once it happens, the way we can help parents, and I imagine if something like this happens to parents, it's a lifelong journey to come to terms with it. But the main work would be about this question of who is to blame.
Yes.
And that is where we need to understand that in life, there is a level of control and prevention that can happen, but there is also the possibility of accidents, of failures, and of things we cannot predict always.
Yes, I think you're talking about the involvement of parents, and that brings me to another question, which is that I've been concerned for some time, it's really looking at a clinical focus, about the fact that adolescents are often seen on their own by clinicians, sometimes with little attention to or involvement with their parents. There's a sort of a sense of, you know, the moment they turn 13, they are somehow an independent person. They are perfectly entitled to be seen on their own. And this seems to me to be contraindicated, given that so many problems in adolescence are almost always connected with parental, relational, and family issues. And I've noticed that clinicians justify this by referring to confidentiality, which in some ways doesn't really make sense. What I also wonder whether there's some sort of premature uncoupling of the adolescent from the family, when in fact a lot of this for adolescents, it's often not exactly the last time, but a very significant time when a lot of earlier trials and tribulations really need to be sorted out. So, you know, I, for example, am very always involved parents as far as I possibly can. And I just wonder what your thoughts are about this.
I think it's actually even perhaps more important in adolescent years to involve parents in the work. One of the reasons is that, as you rightly said, we all exist within a social context, within a family context, and adolescents, of course, are still living with their parents. They go to school. So these two contexts, school and family, can help us. They are solutions. They are part of the solution to the problem the adolescent faces. And we need to involve parents in the work in order to help the adolescent by helping the parents, but also in helping the parents feel they can help their young person. Because often parents come with a feeling of hopelessness. And particularly when their adolescent is really in distress, you know, they may be self-harming, they may be suicidal, they may be very depressed. The parent will feel sometimes incapacitated, that they can't help, they don't know how to help, they lose their parental capacity and even authority sometimes. And so helping them, first of all, helps the adolescent directly because, as you said, they live in a social context and that's part of why they are as they are. But also it helps indirectly by helping the parent feel a bit more that they can support their son or daughter. I do think, in terms of confidentiality, I think it is important for the adolescent to, of course, have a confidential space. And in my own discussions with parents and adolescents, the way I explain that is that I do say to the young person, I will be talking to their parents from time to time. I involve them in the assessment very closely. I value their point of view. I see them as, in a way, co-workers with me to help their son or daughter. I discuss confidentiality very openly. So if, for example, the young person is self-harming or may feel suicidal and the parents know that, I won't then keep giving reports on it. I will take it as a given that they know it, and I will not, it's not helpful for an adolescent that the parent will continuously hear about details of what's going on. But if there is a change in the risk and there is heightened risk, it is important to involve parents. But as a general rule, it needs to be balanced. So some separate time and some together time so that we have a both and approach. I don't agree with completely separating the adolescent work from the work with parents. And I know there are different views on this, but I think it's not helpful.
Thank you very much. And then finally, Maria, I wonder if you can identify, this is a huge question, the particular challenges adolescents and their parents face today. I know this can be very difficult, but I just wonder if there may be one or two key messages you might want them to keep in mind, both adolescents and parents.
Well, I think in today's world, one big challenge adolescents face is, of course, climate change. And that is something just wider that parents and young people have in mind a lot. In terms of hope for the future and how anxiety can be understood, how they can be helped to see the future as a hopeful place for them to go towards. So that's a wider social change that is important for us to keep in mind. In terms of how parents can help their young people, I guess it is important to try to strike a balance between, on the one hand, having some parental authority and firmness in their approach as parents, and often parents will feel they lose their capacity to, they worry they lose their capacity to be firm or to set rules for their adolescents. So it's important to keep an aspect of that, but at the same time to really understand that for adolescents it's very normal to push boundaries and to kind of not comply 100% and to defy rules to some degree. So to really keep some flexibility, and that's a difficult balance to strike, and I don't think it can be perfectly struck ever, but it's important for parents to show themselves some empathy about their own difficulties in trying to strike this balance. The other thing it's important for parents to keep in mind is that there is such change, normal change during the adolescent years. It's very important for them to try to keep their cool, and that it's almost as if you're in a boat and you're sailing and you're going through a period of turbulence, but the boat is able to sail and will continue the journey. And during this period of turbulence where things can feel very worrying at times, it's really important for parents to support themselves and look after themselves and try to keep a sense of humor and as much as possible a cool head, because it can feel as if things will always be like this. And they really won't. Adolescents mature and change, and time and development play a very big role. So I think we do in our clinic a lot of work with parents of adolescents, and it's very important just for them to have that support, a space where they can talk about where they're going through, where they can share their worries, where they can sometimes find things to enjoy or to laugh about, and not just be in constant worry and pain about what's going on with their child, and to just think that with time, it will most likely improve, and with the right support. So,
well, I think that's very, very heartening and very interesting. I mean, I think what is also interesting about it, I like your image of the boat. You know, the boat sails, and the waves come in. There's a bit of turbulence, but I suppose the other thing that's very reassuring, which we know from infancy onwards, is that the child will grow, the baby will grow, the young child will grow. And the adolescent will really grow up. So Thank you so much, Maria. I think it's extremely interesting, and I've certainly learned a great deal. So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you as well, Ruth. Thank you for having me.
Hello, this is Dr. Ruth Schmidt-Nevin again. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. You may be interested to know about my audio trainings based on the many trainings I have run throughout Australia and overseas. These include training on relationships, attachment and the brain, time-limited psychodynamic psychotherapy, and skill building in therapeutic work. You can access the details of all my trainings on my website, which is at www.centerforchildandfamily.com. That's A-N-D, so www.centerforchildandfamily.com. Thank you.